Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Choir Fam Podcast.
I'm Dean Leithy, the Director of Choral Activities at Washington State University.
And I'm Matthew Myers, the Associate Director of Choral Activities at Washington State University.
Back in 2021, we yearned for more connection with choral colleagues we had not seen in months or years and sought out ways to bring our choral community together. We started this podcast to spark more conversations about the current state of choral music and what it will look like in the future.
So here we are. We bring guests from the worldwide choir fam onto the show to share their wisdom and help make our choral world a little bit closer. We hope that by listening to each guest's story, you can find interesting tidbits of knowledge and fresh ideas that you can use in your day-to-day rehearsals.
We also hope that our conversations about the current issues in our field will help us all to move the choral art form forward and make its role more prominent in our society.
We hope you'll enjoy these conversations as we work to strengthen our choral community. Welcome to the Choir Fam.
Good morning, Matt. Today's a beautiful day. How are you doing?
Doing quite well. Yeah, it really is weird feeling like we're coming down the home stretch of this semester. I feel like, yeah, this year stayed so busy, and it's really weird to see that light at the end of the tunnel, mostly for the students, knowing that they're finally nearing that summer break. How are you doing, Dean?
I'm doing well. I'm caffeinated. My friends know that I love green tea. In 2019, my wife and I went to China for a residency to do some conducting and some other things, and was introduced to really wonderful green tea. And so every morning I have my green tea. I also throw some jasmine pearls in there. I am ready to go and excited for our podcast today. This is going to be a great day.
I was just thinking, Dean, maybe season 5 lightning round questions. What's your caffeine of choice?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that could be a good one. I want to know my fellow Diet Coke people. But maybe, Dean, you were kind enough to invite our guest today. Would you like to tell our audience how you know him and why you've brought him here?
Sure. So in 2012, Vic and I were selected for the ACDA ICEP program, International Conductors Exchange Program, which is something we may talk in a little bit. But through that, I had an opportunity to meet Vic, and those people that have met Vic before, he leaves an impression, one of warmth, one of humor. And, you know, Vic, we haven't talked much. You know, I think maybe we've seen each other like once since then. But the presence during those times have stuck with me. And since then, I've followed your career at Baylor as well as Chattanooga Boys Choir. And so I thought that this might be an interesting time for our audience to get to know you as well.
That's very kind of you. And yeah, there are a lot of those hallway meetings and waving hello on your way from one intro session to a concert kind of moments. But they do kind of all the memories flood right back and the good feeling. So thanks for the kind words, and certainly have the same to say of you, my friend.
So audience, if you don't know Vic, here's a little bit more about him. So since 2006, Mr. Oakes has served as Director of Choral Music and Music Instructor at the Baylor School, a grade 6 through 12 independent day and boarding school in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Under his direction, the choral program has grown to include over 200 participants in 4 student choirs, and a faculty choir. In 2015, he was awarded Baylor's Glenn Ireland Chair for Distinguished Teaching and started his service as chair of Baylor's Fine Arts Department, beginning with the 2019-2020 school year. Mr. Oakes also serves as Artistic Director of the Chattanooga Boys Choir, a music education and performance organization founded in 1954, which now includes over 120 choristers ages 8 through 18 in 5 ensembles. Including innovative performance opportunities and collaborative community initiatives, the CBC maintains a performance calendar of 30 appearances annually. The choir has performed and toured extensively, including performance tours to Europe, Canada, and Cuba. recording opportunities for the CBC have included commercially released recordings with Stephen Curtis Chapman, Casting Crowns, and the Grammy-nominated Naxos recording of Maurice Ravel's L'Enfant et les Sortilèges with the Nashville Symphony Orchestra. He is former president of ACDA's Southern Region, and in 2012, he was selected as one of seven conductors to represent the United States at the inaugural ACDA International Conductor Exchange Program in Cuba. As a conductor and clinician, he has conducted numerous honor choirs and festivals throughout the United States, including ACDA regional honor choirs. A lifelong advocate for music and worship, he has served churches in Florida, Georgia, and Tennessee, and as a clinician and conductor for children and youth choirs at Lake Junaluska, Massanutta Springs, and Montreat Church Music Conferences. Mr. Oakes earned the Bachelor of Music Education degree from the University of Florida and the Master of Sacred Music degree in choral conducting from Emory University. He has contributed articles to the Choral Journal and a chapter in the textbook Choral Pedagogy, 3rd edition, by Robert Sadeloff and Brenda Smith.
So, Vic, thanks for joining us and welcome to the Choir Fam.
Thanks for having me. What a joy.
Great. How's your day? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And my favorite color is blue. That's the only other thing.
We missed that.
Very kind of you.
Yeah. So, how's your day going? You had mentioned that as soon as we get done here, you get a room full of seventh graders. So, you got a busy day today.
They're all busy, but they're all great. You know, kids and music, kids and music. That's what I just keep telling myself.
So, Vic, we ask all of our guests the same question to get things rolling. It's intentionally open-ended, so take it however you like. But how did you fall in love with choral music?
That's a great question. And I would, in full disclosure, I would say it wasn't the music I fell in love with right away, but it was really the community that I found. I grew up in a small central Florida, pretty rural town, about an hour south of Disney World. And it was great. You know, I played Little League baseball. I raised pigs. I hung out with all the friends in the neighborhood and at school. But, you know, as things started to get a little more divided up as far as middle school and so forth, we were given a form, right, that every kid receives. And it says, do you want to be in choir, band, or the vocational wheel, which was, you know, agriculture and home ec and things like that. I had been raising pigs all my life, and my brother and I had been cooking and doing laundry since we were really young, so I thought I didn't need home ec. Thought about band for a minute, but I saw my brother lugging a trumpet on and off the bus for several years and hitting people in the knees and almost getting into fights, and I didn't want a part of that. So I thought choir would be kind of the best route to take. No training, no piano lessons as a kid, no youth choir or children's choir to be a part of. Just fell into middle school choir, and instantly I was taken with the opportunity that was formed so quickly of people from all over the campus. The folks who really excelled in the classroom, the starters on all the athletic teams, the kids who kind of kept it themselves, you know, those of us who ended up in choir, however we ended up there. It wasn't lost on me very quickly about how we were all able to magically be united in this common purpose for this common good, making a product, if you want to use that word, that was truly greater than the sum of ourselves. And it was magic to me very early. And I found that I was okay at it. I had a teacher that was super encouraging, super supportive, very positive, encouraged me to try a couple of things, some solos and trying out for Allstate and those kinds of things. And the more I was invited to do those things, the more I felt like it was something that I enjoyed doing. I still didn't think that I would ever consider it as a profession. But the more and more that I had that sense of community, I saw it in high school as well. Friends, actually folks that maybe wouldn't even consider themselves friends outside the choir room, somehow were the best of buds inside that chorus room. And we were able to, again, unite for this common purpose and do this really beautiful thing together. And I really loved that. And I just wanted to be a part of forming that community, however it was to occur, whether it was the style of music, opportunities to perform, trying things in a small setting or with a smaller group. It was just, I thought it was kind of absolute utopia, the best of everything in that one space, doing that one activity together.
So at what point you're singing in middle school, then perhaps in high school, And at what point did you say to yourself, you know, this may be something that I'd like to do either for the rest of my life, or I have so much interest in this that I'd like to pursue further studies for college, university. So when did that happen for you? And when that happened, what were you thinking? Teaching, performing? How did that go for you?
Right. Well, I still, people will say, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I say, I'm still figuring that out, but aren't we all to some degree? I was definitely late in that process. I actually applied to colleges at first as a journalism major. I really liked writing. I don't know that I was all that good at it, but I really enjoyed telling stories and was intrigued about just the idea of telling other people's stories and in a journalism kind of fashion, exploring what was going on in the world around me. But I originally applied to colleges, again, as a journalism major, but my high school choir director, as well as one of the voice teachers, Ron Berichter at the University of Florida, where I had applied to as a journalism major, he said, you know, we probably have a better chance of getting you a music scholarship if you'll become a music major. And this was at a large public university where they did have scholarship funds for non-majors at the time. And, you know, growing up a pretty poor kid and a pretty rough and tumble part of the state, I'd said, I will take anything I can get and I'll do whatever I need to do. So I thought, you know, I could become a music major for a semester or a year and then always switch back. And then thankfully, I never made my way back to the registrar's office. You know, I auditioned, was accepted as a music ed major, and then just fell in love with it. I got there at a very interesting time. We were kind of between choral directors. And so as an undergraduate, my second year, I was actually given what was formerly a graduate assistantship to, you know, get the music together, order uniforms, print out programs, that kind of thing. And so I was able to kind of see the other side of it, you know, all the organizational things and also, you know, the way that these relationships were built and developed on campus. And so I fell in with that part too, because sometimes we get folks who are all about the music and then anything, you know, all the other stuff starts to scare them away. So I was just at a very fortunate time. But very soon after I made that switch to music ed, I realized, as I've often been told, if there's nothing else you want to do, then you're right in the right spot. And that very quickly became the case.
So tell us a few things about the University of Florida that kept this alive for you. I mean, you have experiences at the high school and then you moved to college, and the university is just a completely different experience. And there must have been something amazing that happened to you that you said, rather than continuing on as a music major, that I got the scholarship, thank you, I'm going to journalism. So what happened there that made you stay?
You know, it was a combination of those things. At the University of Florida, our music education program was very strong. Russell Robinson, a very noted arranger and teacher and professor, was my music ed choral methods professor. And, you know, he would, you know, had his finger on the pulse of, you know, what was really going on, as opposed to teachers you sometimes hear about who haven't been in a school classroom for 25 years or something like that. Again, my voice teacher, Ron Berichter, got to know him in such a supportive, musical, insightful way that he really connected helped me to connect on a very deep level about what the intentions of the composer, the possibilities with the choir. And again, with my voice teacher also being a choral person himself, you know, that transfer was very easy. So starting my sophomore year, James Morrow, who recently retired from the University of Texas, came in as our choral director. And that was when I had gotten this former graduate assistantship to kind of just hang around and do all kinds of work. I just got to see how at a 40 or 50,000 person university, kind of the role that singing played. Again, maybe on a larger version of my middle school experience, we had folks that were playing varsity level sports at the University of Florida, folks that were journalism, but also architecture and pre-law and all these other things. You know, I saw as people were in the emerging part of their budding careers, that music was still very important to them. And then within our program, we were doing things like tenor bass choir days, hosting state choral festivals. They had us our sophomore year, which I think was really important. Our sophomore year in the music ed program, we were already doing field experiences, going out into local schools and seeing how what we were learning in the classroom was put into practice. On a very practical level, it could be, you know, so you could realize early on in your educational career that if this isn't the path for you, you could get out before you got stuck with a degree you didn't want. But more importantly, I just continued to be affirmed in that choice that this is what I wanted to do. And it kind of goes back to that middle school experience, which is if I could help make that experience possible for others, you know, for me, it happens to be through choral music. For other people, it could be through sports. For other people, it could be through the love of the English language, whatever it might be. But just kind of creating community, creating places where everybody has a voice, literally and figuratively.
So you're looking at perhaps being a music teacher, again, being that middle school educator that you loved that experience there. And so you're going to do that. Now, where does a Master of Sacred Music degree come in there? How did the whole thing with Emory go? What was the path towards there? Did you teach first or did you go straight there? Tell us about that path.
Well, there's a couple of good points to that. I should also add my experience at the University of Florida also came side by side with an opportunity to work at a large student-serving United Methodist Church, University of United Methodist, while I was an undergrad. And similarly, I also saw the role that music and worship played in the lives of particularly young people, you know, people who were, you know, still learning in their faith and kind of, you know, out on by themselves on their own for the first time and seeing how that continued to connect. So that certainly was running with my formal, if you will, music education. And so I kind of continued on in that way. And so by continuing to work in the church, I thought that was going to be another path for me. However, when I finished at the University of Florida, I went and taught middle school choir. It actually ended up being at my old middle school, the one where all the magic had happened. I've heard a few stories like mine where I actually was supposed to student teach in other places. I was supposed to be at a high school and a middle school. And the night before I started my high school placement, Russ Robinson called me and said, "Hey, we're going to actually cut your high school placement short. And we're going to put you in this middle school and it's going to be your job. And we're going to call that your student teaching." And it just happened, kismet, that that was actually my old middle school that I attended as a child. So at any rate, that then became a job, which was pretty great. So to graduate with some job security was a pretty good thing. But then I knew that there was another step. And so at the time, Emory University, in combination with the Candler School of Theology on the campus there at Emory, offered the Master of Sacred Music degree. Number one, it was the chance to study with Eric Nelson, who, of course, is now with the still at Emory, but also with the Atlanta Master Chorale. And it was also a really unique program that went through all the corners of the masters in music that you would expect, the history, the repertoire, the conducting, the pedagogy. But then also you took classes in public worship and hymnody. And it was just a really good combination of my interests and what I thought the skills would be that I would want to have going forward, wherever I ended up, be it in the classroom, be it at the church. And so when I graduated, I did end up with the boys choir, but then also have had several church positions ever since. And I feel well positioned, you know, when those things come up, that I get to be familiar in all the different avenues of worship and music.
Wonderful. So did you say that once you completed that master's degree, was Chattanooga the next step then? The boys choir was the first thing?
That's exactly right. I had an opportunity for a couple different opportunities immediately out of grad school, some educational, some churches. But the biggest factor at that time was my fiance then and my wife now. She was able to find employment with the company that she was interning with as an undergrad. And so it became kind of a geographical thing. So when some opportunities came up for me, Chattanooga was the one that kind of checked all of our boxes with very satisfying professional possibilities, as well as, you know, living in within 30 miles of each other tends to be good for new marriages. So it worked out really well, but I couldn't have spelled Chattanooga before I learned of this position. Growing up in Florida and then grad school in Atlanta, and Chattanooga for me is pretty north. But it's been awesome ever since, all 21 years of it.
So what was the experience going like from, again, sort of onboarding and re-entry into, you know, you're at a master's level, you're at Emory, you are perhaps conducting for recital. You're in ensembles that are at the master's level, the graduate level, or undergraduate level, depending on where, you know, the ensembles there were. Perhaps you toured, perhaps you did all of this stuff, maybe even at a professional level. And then now you're at the Chattanooga Boys Choir. Not knowing what that organization looked like when you got there, or what it could be, how was that transition for you?
That's like a great question. And I will say, you know, the part of my time previous to that, that what would have prepared me was that little bit of time teaching middle school and then, you know, the choral methods courses. You know, I meet with a lot of undergraduates who feel like, you know, they already have their life planned out and they're going to teach high school, then they're going to go get their BMA, and then they're going to go and teach the college level. And, you know, and then I say, great, how do you help a 13-year-old adolescent boy in the middle of the voice change? Not so much. and it's always fascinating to me, but I definitely would not have said with confidence that I knew the answer then, you know, 21 years ago. So the Chattanooga Boys Choir has been around since 1954, and I am its fifth director in that time. So this organization is now 70 years old, and it was originally founded, you know, out of kind of that tradition of musically, probably owing to the Anglican cathedral choirs, but definitely on the ground functionally, kind of as an option for boys to have something to do 70 years ago. I often hear it spoken about that it was either boys choir, boy scouts, or both. And so things have changed. You know, there's a million things to participate in and competitiveness and select travel, all that, and as well as other opportunities of all kinds that are wonderful. So the group has certainly maneuvered and shifted and changed to meet the needs and to represent the community over that time. But yeah, it was a bit of a shock, but I knew that it was also, you know, as far as as much of a secular ministry could be had, I think it's definitely that as well. You've got kids coming in who, you know, they like to sing, but maybe the participation is very low at their school or not possible at their school. We have a pretty large homeschool population here in Chattanooga. We've got lots of private and independent and public schools. So we get to be a bit of a place where that all comes together, again, for that common good. You know, we're not trying to beat the other guy on the field or have more points at the end of the day. So it definitely has that feeling. You know, we're working on an arrangement of Gibson's arrangement of This Little Light of Mine right now. And we, I asked the leading question and I had the boys all put answers on post-it notes. It was, how does your light shine? going to the lyrics from the piece. And the answers were amazing. You know, I kind of expected, I'm nice to my brother. I pick up my clothes. I do the dishes, you know, and I had things in there like, you know, I'm visiting with my grandparents. I hope it's not for the last time. I held my friend's hand while they were crying, you know, it just, you know, allowing them to express that. And it really, it shows through in our rehearsal process and it comes through in performance. But pedagogically, you know, I got to really kind of hone in on the importance of what we get to do and how we get to create music in that community youth kind of area. And thankfully, we've been going pretty strong for 70 years and looking forward to the next 70.
So we were talking a little bit prior to going on air with the podcast about some of the wonderful things that are happening in terms of representation with trying to get more women conductors and trying to allow maybe a male-dominated society for certain things happening. And now we're trying to open doors for everybody to do all of this and enable that. And in what way, then, how does the boys' choir allow that representation? It's, you know, having these somewhat gendered ensembles can, you know, lead to some challenges that way, or perhaps it leads to some great questions and to some great answers too. So could you talk just a little bit about that?
Absolutely. You know, people have often questioned, you know, why a boys choir? And I think the answer 70 years ago is different now. But there's are several. And I would start with just pedagogically, you know, when I do certain presentations or in services, I show a book from, I think it's a textbook from the 1930s or so, and it's a kind of a primer to conducting. And it has your typical titles in the table of contents, you know, patterns, working with instruments, different, you know, musical topics. And there's a chapter actually entitled The Boy Singer and Its Problems. The context being that the school of thought 70 or 100 or 50 years ago was often for that very dramatic vocal change when the boy's voice started to use the colloquialism to break or to change, you know, they would have this wonderful instrument that they've developed over years. And then when the challenges came because of the pedagogy, or because of the physiology, they were often encouraged just to not sing, you know, to give it up for a while and then to come back when their voice had settled or had finished, quote unquote, changing. The research now tells us that it takes quite a while. But more importantly, those boys often found other things to do. And we had very few that came back. And so we've had other structures in place historically, you know, to try to keep that from choir schools to paid singers and things like that. But by and large, you know, we see this big flip-flop. And, you know, how many conversations and how many sessions at professional conferences do we hear about where are the boys? How do we get more men singing? And so to your point, you know, there is a bit of an upside down glass ceiling when it comes to, you know, we do have a lot of a male dominated society in conductors, and historically we have had that leadership has largely been male dominated. And so we're starting to see some of that change. But the discrepancy has been actually in the singers and in the participants, where the typical school programs, even in well-known community children's choirs, they're often very female dominated. There are very few boys singing. You know, I will go to different conferences and see children's choirs present that just do a phenomenal job. But given what I do, I'll always count. And often it's a 10-to-1 or more ratio. And is that societal? Perhaps. Is it pedagogical? As in, do we have teachers and those that are equipped to help boys singing through the voice change and to have repertoire that helps them to feel valued? I think we're coming along. The music is catching up. The pedagogy is being spread and more widely known and disseminated. But it is a tricky thing because, you know, we do have a lot of things to correct and a lot of errant ways to redirect when it comes to balance. But this happens to be one that is a little tricky, and I know it's tricky to talk about. But it really has to do with just that lack of numbers. And so, you know, the Chattanooga Boys Choir, we've got, you know, around 100 to 120 guys from grades 3 through 12. And what that environment does is it allows us to program music that they feel like we are really catering, particularly to the voice change, but also even in the unchanged voices that they're getting ready, you know, musically to have those experiences. And then those that are going through the voice change, they have some really good high school models that they get to sing along with for SATB repertoire, that they're able to find themselves, like that there is an end to this. You know, there is a goal going through all this storm and stress. And that's very empowering, you know, to be able to see that and to hear that and to participate with that. And so that's been kind of the role that we have helped to fill more recently.
Now, you had mentioned, you know, as you were starting out, that question of like, how do we teach a 13-year-old going through the voice change? Just on a basic level, what would be your biggest pedagogical advice for someone working with that age group for how they can best support and teach those students?
Yeah, there's so many things, everything from the kind of modeling we're doing to the kind of repertoire that we are programming to how we're asking those adolescent voices to access their voice. It's a couple of things. Number one, you know, find ways to make them feel successful. For instance, gosh, some of my groups for the first month or so at school, all we do is sing rounds, and I will pitch them up or I'll pitch them down. Or I'll give octave, you know, choices to make them feel successful. Because, you know, here we are trying to teach breath and phonation and structures and placement and registration, sometimes on notes that are inaccessible, you know, and that's like trying to, you know, learn how to drive a car with no gas. So by finding something that they can have some success on, you know, and to practice all those things we want them to practice, We'll then start to open up the doors, so that way when you're able to select repertoire that helps to fit most of the singers, you're never going to get it perfect. But when they've been able to practice all those things that make them feel successful, they'll be able to put that on the repertoire. It might be reverse engineering to some degree, but it really is about giving them that physical sensation of I'm good at this. The other part to that is continuing the aural training, as in, you know, making sure their ears grow with their voices. You know, I hear from a lot of teachers that octave displacement is a really big thing with those adolescent singers, those eighth grade boys, you know, and some of it's just being able to make a game out of it. You know, I'll have them match me up an octave. I'll flip it around, have them match me down an octave, and just kind of isolate that, you know, that we're going to play the octave game today, versus kind of a scolding way when you're in the middle of rep and someone's singing too low and you just kind of point and say, that's too low. You know, that's a little ambiguous for the average 13-year-old. But to give them the strength to identify it in themselves and even practice it, and by being successful at it, they get to, you know, shoot a piece of paper into the wastebasket, you know, as their prize. It's, again, practicing the skill that we want to see played out in the repertoire versus, you know, trying to shut the repertoire down. It's having a good bit of play, I would say, that creates some ownership.
So, as part of what you do, you travel around, do honor choirs, and as you mentioned, in services and perhaps conferences and things like that. Sure. You were discussing a little bit earlier, again, pre-air, that you had an experience in which you were either conducting a choir in front of a group of kids, and someone that perhaps looked like you came up and mentioned something. Would you talk to our audience just a little bit about that?
Yeah, we were able to share a little bit that just last week I was with a really fantastic middle school and children's choir festival. And I think there were 200 some kids, fifth and sixth grade, perhaps, as part of his treble chorus. And there was this young man in the front who kind of looked at me and put his hand out to do a fist bump. And he said, "Are you Filipino?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely. And I am." And so he put out his hand and we did the fist bump thing. And we had a nice little exchange. He spoke to me in Tagalog, which unfortunately I've lost my fluency. Because when you grow out of it and don't have the chance to practice it. But we had a really nice conversation. And then his mother reached out to me over Facebook Messenger and talked to me a little bit. And we had several exchanges since, how I was, you know, one of the first people he'd ever seen that looked like him in a choir conducting capacity or even in a teaching capacity. And they had some really good dinner table conversation, as she put it, about having people who look like you and who can represent you. And that's been that was a very edifying exchange for me. And it's happened a few times. I was in Texas a couple years ago, and I was meeting with the undergrad choral conducting and music ed students. And a student came up to me and asked me how my family felt about my becoming a music major and a music education major specifically. In some cultures, you know, music is a rather amateur art, and so to be, especially singing, and so to be a music educator just means you're the head amateur. And so there are some challenges that often come about when the cultural expectation might be to be something that is more financially or status or whatever it might be, you know, some instruments, if you're going to be a concert pianist or a violinist or something, if you're going to be, you know, singularly fantastic at your instrument and performing, you know, that can be seen as a pretty noble pursuit, but choral music and conducting and teaching isn't always held in that regard. And we had a very deep and earnest exchange. Fortunately, my parents really just wanted me to be happy. My mother was a teacher and a community college professor, and she knew and valued education a great deal. And so when she knew that I was wanting to become a music teacher, she didn't balk at that at all. It was just, you're going to be helping kids and you're going to be happy. But that's not the case in some other cultures. And so I've had the good fortune at a lot of these conferences to kind of be treated to lunch to entire student chapters at ACDA or to just share some time with students from my culture and others to talk about that distinct arena of of having representation, of seeing what opportunities there are, of sharing opportunities where we might find musical material from our cultures and find ways to share that on a broader scale. Something that you and I experienced as a big part of our Cuban experience about how do we make this music more widely accessible to others, because it was so rich and very much unlike a lot of what we were exposed to already here in the States.
Well, I think that that is a wonderful time to transition. What do you say, Matt? Should we go on to our lightning round?
Yeah, let's do it. So, Vic, we've got a series of questions for you, and we ask you just not to think too hard about your answer. Whatever comes to mind is a great answer for today. Just a chance for our audience to get to know you a little better. First question, are you a night or morning person?
I used to be a night person, and I'm slowly becoming a morning person. How's that for an answer?
What is your least favorite chore?
My least favorite chore? That would be, at this time of the year, cleaning the back porch, because it's covered in a constant blanket of pollen. And I often have to, one of my COVID leftovers is a mask that I'll wear while I'm sweeping out the back porch.
If you were an Olympic athlete, in what sport would you want to compete?
My wife is a very competitive swimmer, and I've become a big fan of hers. And so the more I grow to appreciate that sport, I'd like to think that I would be able to do that. But I'm really, really, really bad at it.
If you could pick a book or TV show to turn into a Broadway musical, what would that be?
Well, awkwardly enough, we discussed this pre-air, The Office, no doubt. I just think it would be incredible to see all those personalities played out in song. There's a lot of good music in The Office. And then the second choice would be The West Wing. That would definitely be one that I'd love to see those dramatic roles. During the height of COVID, some friends and I, we would host several online trivia nights. And The West Wing was one of our common themes, and I created a Music of the West Wing trivia game one night for a Zoom trivia round, and that was, I think it was my highlight for the COVID era.
Now, if you were to cast yourself in either or both of those musicals, which part would you want to play?
Yeah, well, I'd want to be Jim from The Office for sure, you know, get to be the hero. And then from The West Wing, I would probably want to be Josh Lyman, Brad Whitford's character.
Yeah, he's the best character.
Right?
What is your favorite teaching trick or hack?
Wow. So actually, it maybe it's my favorite just because it's the one that I'm doing right now. This is kind of the time of the year where we're able to dig a little deeper than the notes and the rhythms and the words. And so I will take several of our pieces and I will make Mad Libs out of them. I will remove parts of the text and hopefully the kids don't know it. I'll put on the board, give me a noun, give me a verb, give me an adverb, you know, whatever it is, occupation, whatever is reflected in the text. And then they fill out the, you know, the part of speech. And then I then surprise them and show them what song I took that from. And they have to put that text, or those words, into the original text in the context of the original song. And it just makes them think about the text a little differently. It makes them kind of access, you know, the importance of the musical line. You know, if we were singing about a flower and the line decrescendoed, how is it different if we're singing now about a basketball? and so it's just a way of looking at the music a little differently. And I've had some really hilarious answers the last couple of days.
If you had to pick one favorite choral piece, what would it be?
Oh, that's just not fair, is it? Wow. So probably going way back to the beginning, it would be that piece that kind of did make me think that I could maybe do this, the Palestrina Sequit Cervus. My high school choir director, in her wisdom or haste, allowed me to student conduct that piece probably my 10th or 11th grade year. And I didn't know what I was doing. I just kept moving my arms around. And then more and more, I kept going back to it and finding the imitative lines, the canonic entrances, the little duets here and there, whatever it might be, and just realized, you know, I didn't know that, you know, when I thought she put me in front of an old Ford, that I was actually driving a Ferrari of a piece. And that, yeah, the way that the conductor and teacher the role that they have to play in helping make that come alive for the singers. So and it's just a gorgeous piece of music to listen to as well. So that would probably be it.
What is one composer that you feel needs more attention?
Oh, wow. You're really asking the tough ones here. I'm just a huge fan of Sherry Blevins. Sherry is a longtime middle school choral director, and she now has been full-time composing. She's out of North Carolina, and she writes in this beautifully accessible, emotional, deep way that helps to connect. And I don't mean just in a way that, you know, kids like her music, though they do. But she's writing from someone who's very knowledgeable about that voice, but is also using her music as a platform to help people explore more deeply their own thoughts and emotions. And she somehow has a way of capturing that idea that music elevates speech. So she's just absolutely fantastic. She's got new stuff coming out all the time, and each one better than the one before. And she's also quick to share, you know, her own inspiration behind each piece and what her voice is and trying to say something. And so Sherry Blevins just really knocks it out of the park, amongst many others that I just adore.
What is your favorite memory associated with choral music?
This is going to be a challenge. I had one recently. It might become one of my favorite memories. It certainly is one of my favorites right now. I mentioned earlier when I was at Emory University in grad school, I sang with what is now the Atlanta Master Chorale. We were technically the Atlanta Sacred Chorale then, conducted by Dr. Nelson. And I just loved being a part of that group. I actually proposed to my wife while the chorale, we were on tour, we were performing at the Piccolo Spoleto Festival in Charleston, South Carolina, and actually proposed in Charleston while we were performing there. So I'd already had a very deep appreciation and admiration for Dr. Nelson and for the ensemble. But a couple of months ago, Dr. Nelson reached out and said that they were preparing the Bernstein, the Chichester Psalms, and asked if there was a boy soprano from Chattanooga that might be able to fill the role in the second movement, you know, the Adonai Roi. And I said, I think I've got one and lives in my house. I have a 13-year-old son, and he's a great musician. He comes by it, you know, by his own interest, and he's playing trombone in the middle school band right now. And but he's a great little singer, and but also he's very keenly aware of the choir, the choral process. And so I played it for him, and we sang it through one time back around Christmas. And I said, "Would you be interested in trying this?" And he said, "Yeah, sure." And so this is just a couple of weeks ago. And so we actually went down to Atlanta, and he sang two concerts with them. It had all the reasons to go wrong. He sang up in the edge of a balcony with the choir and the instruments on the stage and Dr. Nelson on the stage. He kind of had to come out of the audience and stand by himself, and the light came up, and he just knocked it out of the park. And it was one of those things where, you know, it was my own son. It was beautiful music. It was a choir that I used to be a part of, and a conductor that I've always admired and respected. And so that's probably one of my favorite ones, but goodness, there are so many.
Wow, that's really neat. Yeah, that's great. What projects are you working on right now that you're excited about?
Oh, wow. Well, there's lots. My dear friend Andrew Manier and I, Andrew's with a professional choir in Orlando. We were in college at the same time in Florida. But we'll be conducting a national youth choir at Carnegie Hall in June, and that's going to be a lot of fun with some really great rep and about 250 singers from around the country. At the boys choir, we are doing some really fantastic work, engaging with multiple constituencies and organizations, both arts related and not arts related, that I think is really going to become a model for how groups like ours sustain and grow post-pandemic. A lot of groups, you know, shut down or are still trying to get their feet underneath them. We were fortunate; we kept going. We rehearsed aboard a riverboat here in Chattanooga. We rehearsed in a minor league baseball stadium. We rehearsed in a college football stadium and did several virtual and recorded projects there. And as a result that we just kept going, we're on pretty good footing now. We actually were able to perform at regional ACDA in 22 because we were moving and kept going. But that group also has been very deliberate about how we are engaging audiences. We've done several performances in local community centers and libraries. We have a collaboration with the Chattanooga Choral Society for the Preservation of African American Song that we've been singing the concert with them every February for now 31 years. Even during COVID, we did some recorded virtual projects. And in the summer of 22, we actually toured together. Back in 22, things were still a little tricky as far as traveling and public spaces. And so we actually did a tour to several civil rights locations and museums in Birmingham, Montgomery, Auburn, and Atlanta, where we performed in the civil rights museums there and then performed in local venues in those cities. We are hosting a tenor bass festival that we do every fall where we bring in guest clinicians and a tenor bass choir. And, you know, for like those choirs I mentioned earlier, school choirs that might have 30 and there's four tenors and basses, you know, this is a day that's all about them. And we really love that. In school performances, just really trying to have more music for more people. And it's been really rewarding and enriching to do that.
Wonderful. Well, Vic, you've reached the end of the lightning round. If our audience would like to get in touch with you or follow you on social media, how could they go about doing that?
Yeah, a couple of websites where you can eventually track me down, ChattanoogaBoysChoir.org, and you can certainly reach me through there, as well as BaylorSchool.org, and that's all one word. The Chattanooga Boys Choir has some, you know, there's contact information on both those, and you're able to find us and reach out. Love to hear from you.
Well, it was great talking with you today, Vic. We thank you, our audience thanks you, and we're happy to call you a part of the choir fam.
My joy. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
I'm Dean Leafy.
I'm Matthew Myers.
And you've been listening to the Choir Fam podcast.
Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you liked the show, please rate and review. If you didn't like the show, please let us know how we can better serve our Choir Fam.
You can follow our Instagram page at Choir Fam Pod, or email us at choirfampodcast@gmail.com. If you have ideas for guests we could invite, or if you'd like to engage us to work with your choir, just send us a message.
We welcome all our listeners.
Yes, you!
To be part of our minisodes. Just look for our episode, Minisode Intro Part 3, from February 16th, 2024, and send us an email with your answers to our Season 3 Lightning Round questions.
We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks again for being a part of the Choir Fam.